And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
In this podcast, I'm going to take on about a dozen of your questions, and there are some goodies. But before I do, I want to discuss for a few minutes here a report that came out from Legg Mason. They're a very large investment manager. And they surveyed some 1,000 U.S. investors. And what they found was that some 31% believe they will have enough money saved to enjoy a comfortable life in retirement. Only 31%. Now, I recently did a podcast about the $12 million decisions. And one of those $1 million decisions is about whether you choose to market time or buy and hold. And it was interesting that in the surveys, 60% of millennials reported making an emotional decision to sell in their 401k plan, because that's where they have most of their life savings, and that they later regretted it. Now, the reason they regretted it, I'm sure, is because after they bailed out, the market went up and they missed the move. And it turns out this is a very common problem. It's interesting that more men, by about 50% than women, have done that. It's also interesting to see that over half of the investors who have kids in their household versus 13% without kids. In other words, you put together concern to take care of the family with a declining market, all of a sudden, the whole thing feels out of control. Whereas when you don't have any kids, you only have to worry about yourself. There's evidently a different state of mind. And 41% of investors with income of over $100,000 compared to only 21% with income under $100,000 found the need to bail out, to market time. And 47% of the investors who were self-identified as having advanced knowledge as an investor bailed. 47% versus only 11% of the beginners. Now, of course, the beginner, somebody just getting started, doesn't have much money at risk. But it may be those people who have built up a sizable pot of savings feel a need to protect it by jumping out of the market. So my conclusion from this, and I agree, by the way, the worst thing that can happen to you is to run out of money before you run out of life. And the most highly probable way that's going to happen is if you make sure you have defended against every one of those risks that we know about. Do all the things about diversification and expenses and savings rate and all of those things that lead to people being successful investors. But if you overcommit yourself to risk, and then find yourself becoming a market timing, you are likely not to be in the 31% who have enough money to comfortably retire. And I know that your emotions want you to find safety at that time that you want to bail. I know you're having a fight between your intellect and your emotions. And you're saying to yourself, If I get out right now, the market's going to turn around and go up. I'll wait one more day. I'll wait one more day and see what happens. This is not about a day. It's about a lifetime. Okay, question number one. I have listened to several of your podcasts now and most recently have read your article, Why You Should Consider an All-Value Portfolio. In the article you wrote, even for retirees, this is worth considering. Many retired investors have accounts that they don't expect to need in their lifetimes. I believe they should consider taking more risk and essentially investing like a young person. Well, probably I should have said, take into consideration that they're investing for a young person, and therefore you might want to invest like a young person. He goes on to say, I am not yet a retiree, but have just turned 48. Now, there's an important piece of information for me because he's right in the middle. He's halfway there. And he says, and so I have about 20 years until I retire. Most of my retirement funds are in the S&P 500, but I want to do better. Now, he didn't say he wanted to push the pedal all the way down to the floor. He wants to do better. Well, if I had him right there in front of me, I would first of all want to figure out how much better do you need to do? I so often find, if I do get a chance to talk with somebody, especially when they're 20 years or 30 years away from retirement, they so often overestimate how difficult it's going to be to get to where they need to go, and that they don't need to get huge returns. So he goes on, so what I'm trying to analyze now is Portfolio 7 versus Portfolio 8. Can you suggest any additional resources that I can use to help me make this decision? Well, let me talk about Portfolio 7 and Portfolio 8. Portfolio 7 is the combination of equity asset classes that represent the asset classes I think you could or should have in the equity part of your portfolio. All 10 of those equity asset classes are good on their own. But as a group, they're a powerhouse because very often when one is sagging and struggling, like the S&P 500, which this fellow owns, did from 2000 through 2009, there were other asset classes that were just streaming on along, doing fine, making historical-like returns that they had, like they had in the past. So that makes it a powerful portfolio, and what even helps more is that potentially there's another 1%, maybe 1.5%, maybe 2% return over what you would get from the S&P 500 on its own. Of course, we don't know how much more it will be. In fact, we don't know that it will be more. But we know that that is what history shows us. On the other hand, by the way, I should have mentioned that in that portfolio, it's about 60% value and about 40% growth, both small and large. Now, if you went to Portfolio 8, what you try to get rid of, and you never get rid of them totally, but you try to get rid of the growth issues and have purely value because that historically is where the return has been the highest. It has been the very highest in small cap value, but large cap value has produced better returns than the S&P 500. Now, when you go to an all-value portfolio, you want to, if it's going to give a better return, how much more risky is it? Well, here's what I know about the history, the worst case year, let's call it, this calendar year. The S&P 500 once lost 43.3% in 1 year between 1928 and 2018. Large cap value, let me give you small cap value first, lost 55.5%. That was its worst calendar year. Large cap value, which we would think would have had less of a loss than small cap value, actually suffered a 61.1% 1 year loss. So if you took the average between the large cap and the small cap value, and that worst year was the same year, the average would have been about a 58% loss versus a 43% loss for the S&P 500. That's about 35% more risk. And for that, you could pick up, we don't know, but you could pick up another couple percent. Now, is it the right thing to do? Well, I don't know enough about this investor to know if it's the right thing to do. He says, I want to do better. He didn't say, I want to get the highest return, because if he had said that about those asset classes, I would have suggested he take on the small cap value. Now, I don't want him to do that at his age. So I would think you could take a step over beyond the S&P 500, and to the extent that your 401k offers it, get the rest of those asset classes. Or if you want to keep it simple, if you have it available in your 401k, you could divide it, rather than having it all in the S&P 500, you could divide it 25% each. S&P 500, large cap value, small cap blend, small cap value. And I think what you'd find is a return that would be 1 to 2% better than the S&P 500, with a risk that will be higher. But when you go out, 15 to 40 years, it turns out that the worst case scenario over the period with the combination is a better worst case scenario than the worst case scenario for the S&P 500. Question number two. This lady says, I would like to solicit your advice regarding where you would keep your money that you're saving for a down payment. I'm currently 24 years old, and I hope to be able to buy a house in the next 5 to 10 years. I have around $20,000 sitting in a Vanguard money market fund because I'm not sure what to do with it. Is the Vanguard short-term investment-grade bond fund a good choice? And if so, should all my money go into that fund? That is a great question, Stephanie. I don't think you should take much risk, and you've already decided that because you asked me whether the short-term investment-grade bond fund would be a good idea. That would be fine for part of the portfolio. You could also look at on my site at paulmerriman.com and go to the Vanguard list of recommendations, and there is a recommendation of what we call the monthly income portfolio. Now, it's not income you're looking for. You're looking for decent income with low risk, whereas the portfolio was originally developed to give somebody who simply wanted to get regular income from a fixed income portfolio that wasn't exactly looking for high security, was willing to give up some of the quality to get a higher fixed income return. And so in that portfolio, it's partly short term, partly intermediate term, partly high yield, partly high grade. It's a portfolio of several different bond funds that do better over time than the Vanguard short-term investment grade bond fund, but still keep you in a portfolio that should grow, not shrink, over the next 5 to 10 years. Now, I'll give you one more recommendation. You could also have half of your money in a short-term investment grade bond fund and the other half in the Vanguard Wellesley Fund. Now, the Vanguard Wellesley Fund is 40% equity and 60% fixed income bonds. So by having a portfolio that's 50-50, you end up with bonds that are not all governments, not all short-term, and that will represent 80% of your portfolio, and the other 20% will be in equities. And the Wellesley Fund has a very fine long-term record, and I don't know that they've ever had a 5-year period that they lost money. Certainly over 10 years, I don't believe they've ever had one. But I think, and they started in 1970, but I think you could have a little bit of equity in the portfolio. Is that going to be a life changer for you? Well, no, it will probably allow you to put a bigger down payment on the house. So if you go the short-term investment grade, I'm not unhappy, better than a T-bill or a money market fund, but it would be nice to, since you have 5 to 10 years, to stretch yourself a little bit and take a small amount of additional risk. Question number 3, what is the best month to rebalance a portfolio? The letter says, email says, I've been rebalancing the ultimate buy and hold annually in December with great success. Does your analysis show it is more advantageous to do it in a particular month? Well, certainly, if it's a taxable account, I wouldn't want to rebalance in December. I'd want to wait until after the first of the year for tax reasons. But other than that, what the studies have shown, that if you had to pick a time of the year, it would be in the January, February, March a period that is best for rebalancing. And having said that, you could probably look at it the next 20 years, and it turns out the best time to rebalance is in the fourth quarter of the year. That's the kind of thing that probably there isn't going to be a huge advantage to doing it in the first of the year, or after the first of the year, but at least that's what our research and others have found. Question number 4. I'm a first-time investor, and I'm trying to decide between using Fidelity or Vanguard. What are the pros and cons of each? Well, Jim, I think that it would depend on the kind of investor you are. Generally, I would give Fidelity the nod if it were about service. They can afford to offer more service because they charge a lot more. The Johnson family has made probably 20 times more money on Fidelity than anybody ever made at Vanguard. I'm talking about internally, the people who run the operation. So they do give better service. That's the feedback that I get. On the other hand, if you are a do-it-yourself investor, I would give the nod, particularly as a small investor, to Vanguard. They both have index funds. They both have low-cost index funds. Now, in the case of Fidelity, they actually have a handful of index funds that don't have any management fee or operating expense at all. And that's certainly a small advantage on those few funds they offer. But since you're an early investor, I'm thinking you may actually be interested in the ETFs that they have, exchange-traded funds that they have to offer at Vanguard. They have 1,800 exchange-traded funds that you can buy that you don't have to pay a commission to buy or to sell. And that's a big deal over time. And by the way, the what we call best-in-class ETFs in the portfolio that we have at paulmerriman.com, all of those ETFs are available through the Vanguard commission-free market. Then I suspect the next question would come, if you were a larger account, would you be better off using the Vanguard privately managed service, where you will get an investment advisor, and it depends on the size of an investor or size of account that you are. That will dictate the kind of advisor, the level of expertise. When you're up over $1 million, I've talked with some of those advisors who handle the over $1 million accounts, and they're very good. And I know what they recommend. They really recommend a very conservative portfolio. You might push them and get a little extra action, but not much, because overall the firm is conservative first. They're working to make sure you have your money and give up. I think they give up a little return, maybe a lot of return, because of that conservative nature. But that's really what a lot of people who have a lot of money are looking for. They're not looking necessarily to hit a home run. They are looking to have some professional advice that will keep them out of trouble. And the fee that Vanguard charges is 30 basis points, about a third of 1%. And Fidelity is, last I saw, was much higher. So maybe you won't get the high touch at Vanguard that you do at Fidelity. But I think at the end of your life, you will likely end up with more money in your account at Vanguard than Fidelity. And I'm sure there are lots of people who have had great success at Fidelity, just as there are a lot of them at Vanguard. Okay. Number five. Many of your recent podcasts have focused on new investors starting out who have limited funds. I understand how ETFs, M1, and Motif help with that. But how would someone who has been following your mutual fund portfolio decide if this new ETF portfolio is a better option? Well, I'm not sure where this person is holding their funds, whether they're at Schwab, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, Vanguard, because we have been recommending portfolios in all of those fund families for years. But should someone who has built up a portfolio of mutual funds be switching over to the ETFs that you can buy, or actually trade commission-free at M1, and be able to buy and sell partial shares? That's kind of a big deal with ETFs. There are some challenges for investors to deal with sources of ETFs where you have to buy a full share, because oftentimes the money you're investing would only buy a half a share, so then you got to figure out, okay, what do I do with that money? So there are some efficiencies at M1 that make it, I think, the best place to do the ETFs in that regard. But if you are in mutual funds, I'm going to assume if you've been following our portfolios that recommendations that you are using index funds, and they are low-cost index funds. If they're in taxable accounts, I wouldn't want you to take a tax hit just to get to the ETFs. Now, there has been a problem at Vanguard, and in fact, a problem at Fidelity with the mutual funds. You can't get at all the asset classes with mutual funds at Vanguard or at Fidelity that you can through the ETFs. So then the question is, maybe in order to pick up those ETFs and those asset classes, because you can get them at Vanguard if that's where you are, you take new money coming in to take the position in those asset classes you haven't had because of the limitations of asset class mutual funds that Vanguard has. So I have generally, when I've talked to people and seen larger accounts that qualify at Vanguard, for example, for the very low-cost Admiral shares, I've told them they probably are just going to be fine sticking where they are. But if there is a reason, a time when there's some money to go into some of those ETFs in asset classes, like small cap international value, that's one in particular that comes to mind that you don't get at Vanguard in the mutual funds. Number six, I'm confused as to why REITs are no longer considered necessary. I thought that REITs were considered necessary for additional asset class diversification and are not replicated in other funds. Has that changed? No, we still recommend REITs in the tax-free or tax-deferred accounts. We do not recommend REITs because of the way that the dividends are taxed in a taxable account. So yeah, no, REITs are still recommended. Number seven, I'm confused about the change from the S&P 500 to a total stock market fund. I thought one of the reasons you didn't recommend a total stock fund in the past is that it contained little outside of the traditional S&P 500 stocks. Well, the total stock market fund has over 3,000 issues versus the 500 in the S&P 500. And their returns are virtually the same. The large cap companies in both the S&P 500 and the total market index are such a large part of the return that having the extra companies in the total market index doesn't move the needle very much. But Chris Pederson is right. We have an opportunity. And by the way, I wouldn't want people moving out of the S&P 500 if they're going to create a taxable event into the total market index. But if you're just coming in and opening up your account with a Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab, the total market index allows us virtually the same return, but with more diversification. And Chris convinced me we shouldn't pass that up, and he's right. I think it's a good idea. It's not going to hold your return back. My concern had always been that I didn't want to overweight your portfolio so much to more risky asset classes that you were going to end up not having enough high quality issues when tough times come. But I'm convinced that you're going to be just fine in the total market index. Number eight, is it possible that so many people know about the small cap premium that index investors will push the prices up to the point the premium is no longer produced. Well, that's, I guess what you're saying is that you could have the same kind of a bubble that happened in the S&P 500 at the end of the 90s, so that for the next decade, the fund basically just, well, in fact, it lost money for the next 10 years. You could have maybe a bubble like the high-tech stocks did, where really, virtually, they lost about 80 to 85% of their value in the 2000 through 2002 decline. And could the same thing happen with value? Well, yes, of course. Now, it doesn't have to be a bubble to have what would consider a long period of time of underperformance. But what we know from the past is that when something is out of favor for a while and it's a good asset class, they come back. And then they push it maybe too high and people take profits, the people who are not in there for the long haul, while other people just ride it out. Maybe that could happen. But I do know that in 1999, that people believed that the small cap premium was finally understood by everybody and therefore it wasn't ever going to happen again, because for the 30 years ending 1999, large beat small. And then since 1999 through 2018, small beat large. So I'm still convinced, and I've had this question given to me about a dozen different ways, I'm still convinced that small cap value is going to produce a better rate of return than large cap blend. And I think small cap value will do better than large cap value. And I suspect that we have to face I'll call it a fact, that a lot of people believe that the return for the S&P 500 for the next decade is going to be very low. And it is certainly likely that the return for small cap value be relatively low. But if it's 1 or 2% better than the S&P 500, it would be nice to have that in the portfolio. The big question, I suspect, in people's mind about small cap value, seeing what it's produced for 91 years, according to the back-tested studies, is that 4 or 5% premium over the S&P 500. Are we going to get that again, Paul, as I'm asked? I want it, and I want it now. Well, here's the reality. Nobody knows. The academics, they won't say, but they don't believe they have any way to know how big that premium will be. They just believe that premium will, in fact, happen. Number 9, I am 35 years old, and I have a question about where is the best place that I can roll over my 401k and put it into a traditional IRA. And then she goes on to say also at my age, is it a good idea to go with all value and all value portfolio? Okay, first, where to go with that rollover? I suspect that Vanguard would be on the list. Certainly Schwab would be a good potential. I do like Vanguard because they have, as I mentioned in an earlier question, they have all those ETFs on a commission-free basis, some 1,800, and we have recommendations for which of the 1,800 you could be in. I also know that you're going to find a fund that is committed to indexing as a primary way to invest, not just another way to invest, as it is with other fund families. So I guess if I had to pick one, yes, I would pick Vanguard. As to whether you should be all value or not, at age 35, I would not be opposed to an all value portfolio. I would also not be opposed to the two funds for life at Vanguard, the combination of the target date fund and a small cap value. In fact, as you, if you've looked at the two funds for life strategy, there is the one way where you multiply your age by 1.5, and that's how much you have in the target date fund, and then you invest the rest in small cap value. You could also take another approach and just put 30% of the money in small cap value along with the target date fund and rebalance on an annual basis. You could do that. And there are a lot of ways to get a bit more aggressive. But the all value portfolio, if you're going to have access to small value and both U.S. and international and large value U.S. and international, even a slice of emerging markets, I think that would be a terrific long-term position. Now, at some point, you're going to have to add the fixed income, and that's, you're going to have to make a decision if you just went with all value without any fixed income, which at 35, I think would be okay. But at 40 or so, you're probably going to want to start adding some fixed income to the portfolio. And one way you could determine that at the time is to see what Vanguard recommends in their target date fund glide path. And so you could, in theory, have an all value equity portfolio and later, after you're 40 or even 45, start adding the amount of bonds that Vanguard shows in their target date fund. Here's a question. This would be question number 10 for Matt. He works at a company, Zayo Group, that is not included in our top 100 companies where we give the 401k recommendations. And he wants to know what he should do to try to match our strategy to his 401k recommendations. Well, here's what he could do. He could send them to us, and we will be happy to take a look at those and do our best to match them to the asset classes that we like in our ultimate buy and hold strategy. Now, typically, you're not going to get access to all those asset classes we'd like to have. We rarely find a 401k that offers small cap international value. As a matter of fact, in most cases, in the U.S. part of the portfolio, they don't offer small cap value. But we'll do the best that we can. We'll give you three levels of recommendations in terms of risk. One will be conservative with 60% in fixed income. One will be moderate with 40% fixed income. And the last one will be all equities, the aggressive strategy. And as I would hope that all the folks that are following our strategies in their 401k, it's really great for us to be able to have others in your company find out about the work that we are doing. And by the way, Matt, it may be that you have target date funds, and maybe you've got a small cap value in your portfolio. You may decide to do the two funds for life, the combination of the target date fund and the small cap value. I hope we put the Zayo group offerings on our site soon. Thanks for getting a hold of us. Number 11 says, thanks for another great podcast. It's really nice to hear from my financial advisor. That's you every week. That's frightening. I am pleased that you take my work seriously enough that you consider me your financial advisor. Your last question today sounded like Ken Fisher. I talked about an investment advisor who had way overexposed the client that they had to equities, and I don't think I'm going to say whether it was Ken Fisher or not, but I would agree it sounds like Ken Fisher. Here's what I want to say. I understand a lot of older folks don't like tables and sheets full of numbers. Fine, let them put their trust in someone other than themselves. I'm a young 63-year-old do-it-yourself retired investor. Please keep coming with those tables full of numbers. That's extremely valuable research for guys like me. My guess is that if the lady you mentioned in your last question had a copy of your fine-tuning tables, she could have saved herself a ton of grief. And I know that's not a question, but I'm taking it as a question. And the question in my mind is, do I cause more confusion with all those tables? And I'm not so sure that for a lot of investors, those tables become way more than they want to deal with. I mean, just take the distribution tables that we have on our site. There are tables for distributions showing the results from 1970 through 2017 or 18. We're still working on some of that for 18. But those tables are fixed, set up for fixed distributions at 3%, 4%, 5%, and 6%. Then we have them in variable distributions with no inflation adjustment. And we have them for the S&P 500, and we have them for the worldwide equity as the equity portion. We have them for all value. We have all of these different combinations of amounts that are taken out with or without inflation adjustment, fixed, variable, etc. And yeah, I suspect it is absolutely overwhelming. But every year when I have the new tables available, I do a podcast. And if you listen to, in fact, I do two podcasts, one for fixed and one for variable distributions. And if you will listen to those podcasts, along with looking at those tables, and I should also mention that we have articles that Rich Buck and I have written on those tables. So, yeah, we probably do way more than we need to. In fact, I'm criticized for the 6% tables because they don't want me, the people that other investment advisors think that it's inappropriate for me to be suggesting that 6% is a legitimate amount of money to take out. Well, if you look at those tables, what you'll see is when you take out 6%, in almost every case, you go broke after a relatively few number of years. I'm not talking about 5 or 10, but you can be broke by the time you're out 20 years by taking out too much. On the other hand, I think it's pretty clear that if you oversave, if you oversave two times, three times what you actually need, whether you got lucky or you were just a great early saver. Now, my wife and I take out 5%, which is more than most people do, but we oversaved. And I'm 75 now. She's not. She's younger, but not much. But when I get to be 80, you know what? I may be taking out 6% a year. Because and by the way, the kids tell me to do it. They say, Dad, just spend it all. By the way, I don't believe that for a minute, but that's what they say. Number 12. And this is a very important question, and one I haven't spent much time discussing over the last years, even since I started in 2012. The question is a long question, but the bottom line is the self-directed Schwab plan the best option for me to implement your advice? Now, here's this fellow's problem. This fellow's problem is that the 401k plan that he has does not give him access to all of the asset classes that he needs. And so, could he do better if he went to the self-directed plan at Schwab? And some people have a self-directed at Fidelity, and some have a self-directed at Vanguard. If you have a self-directed set of investment options, will you do better? Well, okay, why would you do worse? Well, one reason you might do worse is because there's a cost with every investment, and you don't want to suffer that cost. Maybe it's $25. Some people don't have to pay anything. The company evidently pays for it. But yes, I do believe that people would probably put together a better ultimate buy-and-hold portfolio if they used the self-directed part of the plan. And, by the way, I made this promise years ago and never fulfilled it. So here I am again. And I am going to get my hands on a self-directed a list of the self-directed funds at Schwab, at Fidelity, and at Vanguard. And I will put those up as three separate 401k plan recommendations. Now, here's the problem, and the reason I have balked when I've thought about this before. I'm not sure that everybody gets the same list of funds. And my problem is, I didn't want to try to go through 100 or 200 plans, looking at each one of them to see what they're offered. Because in some cases, I know that self-directed doesn't mean you get access to everything that Schwab or Vanguard or Fidelity offers. But I will look at those major fund families and assume you have access to all of those, and we'll put together portfolios for you. So then it's a question of what the expenses are. By the way, if you did it once a year, you moved a bundle of cash over to the self-directed, and let's say you purchased 10 different funds, and let's say they charge you $5 a fund. I don't know what they're charging you. But if it's $5, that means once a year you're going to have to spend $50. That would be a pretty good deal if it gave you access to small cap value, including small cap value internationally. I'll give it a try. Thank you for all your questions. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for allowing me to be one of your guides. By the way, before I leave, I got to tell you, I've had a amazing response to the idea of me doing the series on the 10 top truth tellers. I haven't called George Sisti to find out if anybody subscribed to his newsletter after I read an issue on my last podcast. So I'll be doing one of those probably a month. And the other thing that happened is you're sending me recommendations to be added to the list of truth tellers. And they're great recommendations. It may be I'm going to end up with 12 truth tellers. Whatever it is, it has to start with a T. I mean, I've got to keep it with 10 or 20 or 200. Oh, my God, 2,000 truth tellers. I've got my work cut out. Thanks for listening. All the best to you.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.